3, 2, 1, and you are live.
Aloha, everybody. This is Kathy Bilski, the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite show on UPRN Radio, and this is June 23rd, 2017. Good Lord, can you imagine? It's already almost half the year. Wow. I got a great show for you tonight. I have this incredible friend of mine, Elliot Adams. He's going to come on and talk about Palestine and the Meta Peace team. And before I bring Elliot on, man, I got a few things I just got to get off my breast. Okay. Not going to say chest. I'm going to say breast. And I am so tired. Every single day, I see somewhere in the United States where Republican white racist sexist men are really trying to really make it harder and harder for women to even exist. I mean, let's start off with the white racist sexist males that are afraid of strong women leaders. I mean, come on. If a woman starts to move forward, they seem to gang up on her like a hyena pack. And, you know, most people would say they're wolves. But, you know, to me, I really honor and respect the wolf clan. So let's go a little bit lower on the animal chain and call these racist sexist men what they are, hyenas. Oh, yeah. And if you're a woman of color, holy frick. You know, I can't say the really true F word, but if you really want to see it uncensored, go to my Facebook page, okay? But I have to censor this a little bit. So every time I say frick, no, I'm saying fuck. Okay. Anyway, if you're a woman of color, holy crap, just ask Kamala Harris and Maxine Waters. And, you know, from Elizabeth Warren being told to sit down and shut up for expressing her views, along with any woman politician that speaks out for what is right and just, these women are told to sit down and shut up. Please be seen and not heard. Now these jerks are going after Nancy Pelosi. And for what? Speaking out against this new awful health care bill. What the frick? All of a sudden, a woman is speaking out and they start to demonize her. And you know she's speaking truth. And you best start standing up for these women, guys, because if not, we're going to continue to have white racist sexist men making all our decisions in their favor, trying to push us back into the early 1900s. And I've got two words for those guys. F you. Now, if you think my language is a little too colorful, which are, you know, it's better if you read it on paper, uncensored. You know, I personally have learned that unless you use the F word a lot, men don't take you seriously. You know, sad but true. You know, you talk dick and you get their attention, huh? So what do we do here? What are our options? Well, world enlightenment. That's a biggie. I've talked about it a lot. And doing the energy work that will help these unenlightened beings reconnect to the creator, to become an awakened spiritual being. And that's our only way out, guys. Sorry, everything else has been tried, but constant energy work. Now, these beings are really lack of light, don't you think? Now, if you got any better ideas, please share. And if they're good, I'll share them and we'll apply it. But in the meantime, let's send these white, sexist, racist men some love to their hearts. And let that energy go to the brain and see them being reconnected to the creator, making decisions that are compassionate and kind, which brings joy to many people, including men. And let this high divine energy flow to them 24/7. And while we're at it, we're going to say the same thing with Mitch McConnell. I have not really seen a more evil man on this planet other than Trump and his cronies. But to push a healthcare plan and to do it secretly and to ignore and ignore women. And then you look and see what this bill is. I mean, this man is so lack of light. It's really, really sad. So let's send energy to his heart, because obviously he really needs it, and see his heart cracking from the light being sent to it. And that energy going to his brain. And we're going to ask his higher self to help him step forward in the light and let there be complete and total transparency in everything he does. And if he doesn't want to step forward in light, which is his free will, we're going to ask his higher self and guardian angel to put him in a position of total and complete harmlessness, letting a light worker that is really human take his place. Now, that can mean putting him in a position of harmlessness that he's removed. He retires. He's gotten out of office, okay, where no one will be hurt or harmed. I just want to make that clear. All right, let's fill that energy up, and let's send it to all those white racist, sexist males out there, because they do need help, and women are suffering for it. I mean, the guys, Republicans in Missouri, have want to push forward a new law that says if you have you take birth control, a woman, or if you've had an abortion, you're not going to get a job. I mean, come on, guys. This is really beyond words, is it not? And it needs to be addressed. It needs to be looked at. And their awful rules on abortion are making women go to coat hangers again. And that's fact. So please put these guys in your prayers and send them lots of love to their hearts and see it go to their brain and see them doing works of good. Okay, I'm done. Well, welcome, Elliot. And I'm sorry about that. I've just, you know, I tilted this morning when I saw that about women and not being able to get a job because they're been on birth control. Oh, my God. Anyway, are you still there, Elliot?
I am here, and I was listening to what you were saying, and I think we should take a little time talking about it. I think that for anyone to not believe that there is an active war against women in this country, they're not paying attention. I think that, so let's look a little bit historically. So there's some things that come to my mind. So, for example, women right now are earning 62 cents on a dollar to what a man is earning. That's, you know, doing exactly the same job, but just getting 62 cents on a dollar. Now, of course, that is totally not okay. It's just not acceptable. It's not good for women. It's also not good for men, incidentally, just so people are aware of it. Because when you can hire somebody for 62 cents instead of a dollar, then that pulls the person who is going to get the dollar, their salary down. So men need to understand that they are going to pay a price for that also. Now, we do know that that gap keeps shrinking. It's shrinking steadily. But I'm going to tell you that if your daughter were to enter the job market at age 20 right now, she would get equal pay when she is 62. That is totally beyond reasonable. I mean, that is just totally awful. And I think that we have this sort of idea that somehow this is happening benignly. That somehow is just sort of, I don't know what, the law of nature or something. That isn't the case. The fact of the matter is that the men, and that includes me, have been actively, collectively been actively suppressing women. But for some of us, it actually is sort of passive. Because we are just sort of accepting things like that, like somehow thinking, oh, well, I guess it's really okay that they're earning 62 cents on a dollar for some reason or other. Another one that I think is worth looking at and thinking about is equal rights. Now, we all talk about equality and the U.S. Constitution and how that's supposed to have guaranteed equality. Yet in this country, let's see. Equal Rights Amendment. It was Alice Paul, 1920, who first proposed an Equal Rights Amendment. Now, an Equal Rights Amendment would be, I mean, it's like a no-brainer. We obviously believe everybody should have equal rights, right? I mean, that's just obvious. Yet, she first proposed the Equal Rights Amendment in 1920. This is now 2017, so that's, what, 97 years? So that's 97 years that we have been, that there has been proposals on the table to pass an Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution. And we have not done it for 97 years. That's not an accident. That's not just sort of some benign process. That's happened by a continuous, active, aggressive effort to keep it from happening. Now, I look at that and I think, you know what? We should not allow it to become 100 years. What would be wrong with us as a culture if we were willing to sit back and say, for 100 years, we would have equal rights amendments proposed but not passed? So I think that's our challenge for the next 3 years, is just to pass a damn thing. And I think it's also interesting to look at things like women's suffrage, because I keep hearing people say, well, women were given the right to vote. Women were not given the right to vote. Women took the right to vote. In fact, what actually happened is the President of the United States sent a delegate, he was a reporter, to go to Alice Paul in jail and negotiate with her and say, look, I'll tell you what, we can't give you status as a political prisoner, because most of the suffragettes were claiming political prisonerhood, and they were also, most of them were opposed to the war, World War One. But he said, I can't do that, but if you agree to quit your fight for that, then we will agree to acquiesce on the woman's suffrage. So that was won, but that was won because of active resistance. Now, this is not a struggle for women alone. This is a struggle for men, too. We all are hurt by this process. We all have to work on it. We men have to work on it for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons we have to work on it is because there's a moral responsibility. If we believe in equality, we have to actively work for it, and we have to recognize that our silence is a very important part of maintaining the injustice. We also have to fight for things like, as I mentioned before, if we allow somebody to get paid less, then that will lower our wage. We also have to work for equality, because if your wife, for example, earns less money than she should, your household has less money than it would. We have to work for equality because surely you don't want your daughter to be crushed under this kind of aggressiveness. Aggressiveness isn't the word I want. More viciousness. Why on earth should your daughter not have access to equal jobs, equal pay, equal
respect? How about health care? Just, you know, you guys, they give guys Viagra in insurance, don't they?
Yes, and what the hell is that about? Absolutely.
Okay, now what about, you know,
really real sense.
You know, and then, you know, what do they give us now? What are they doing? They're taking away every single thing for women for health care. You name it. They want it gone.
That's right. And it turns out that almost all of the typical medical issues, or many of the standard medical issues for women are by the insurance companies can be considered as pre-existing conditions. So blanketly denying all women insurance coverage.
You won't give us birth control, yet you get Viagra. Now, how sick and twisted is that?
It is extremely twisted, and it comes back to what I said earlier on. It is unintended pregnancies have historically been one of the strongest, most aggressive controls of women and men have used. And this denying free birth control under insurance is absolutely, as you say, it is absolutely a technique for crushing women. That's what it's about. And I'm going to say something else, and this is maybe not my place to say, but we had this massive women's march, as you all recall, and it was one of the biggest demonstrations in the history of the country. And it spawned, I have no idea how many politically active groups have spawned. So in our little area, there's six of them. I know of six of them in our little area. And they were all, there's men in them. I'm involved with them. I consider myself a men's auxiliary. But one thing that does concern me very much is that of all six of those groups in particular and some other ones I know, none of them have women's issues foremost on their plate. They have chosen to do they're all really important issues. Their global climate change, their health care, they're all very important issues. But we need to have, in order to, I was about to say create equality for women, but what I should say is, in order to quit this unjust attack on women, we need to get out there, and we need active resistance, active constructive resistance to change this, because it's not going to get changed any way other than really, activists really get out there and doing the work. That's what we have to do. We have to get out there and do the work, or it's not going to get done. And damn it, I'm sorry, but we have to. It's crazy. Why are we allowing this kind of injustice to happen? It's kind of like watching black men get killed by white cops and with impunity. These things are wrong, and we have to change them.
Oh, I agree. I mean, yeah, God, I miss talking to you, Elliot. But, we jumped in right into the program. So let me just take a step backward and just tell people who you are, other than pretty incredible male, okay? All right, so Elliot Adams has transformed from a soldier to a nonviolent warrior, applying his intellect and body to building movements that create justice. He dedicates his life to stopping all war, and he served as an Army paratrooper infantry in Vietnam, Japan, Korea, and Alaska. He's the national president of Veterans for Peace, president of the school board, mayor of his village, committee chair of BSA Explorer Post 17, president of Rotary, master of the Masonic Lodge, and he also conducts nonviolent and social movement trainings for organizations all over the place, and really anybody that will that asks you to come, right? And actually, you're going to Palestine, aren't you?
I will be going back to Palestine. That will not be to be doing nonviolence training. That will be with a peace team, with a peace team to do third party nonviolent intervention to try to reduce the violence and conflict, which is a pretty standard technique, and we do that both nationally in this country and in internationally. And we're working on doing some trainings with the Ojete Sakawan, at Standing Rock Nation. So that's another. We view that as an international team because they are a different nation. They're not our nation. They are a different nation. Let me step back and say, basically the way we at Metapeace team view it is that conflict is normal and conflict is natural. And that's maybe partly a question of words, but if I am going to be an individual, then there's going to be conflict around me because I'm going to be different than the people around me. If we're going to embrace diversity, then we're going to be embracing conflict because people are not going to understand each other. People are going to work together in ways that create friction. But what we would say is that what is not normal and not natural is to have violence in that conflict. So my wife talks about me and my conflict partner. If you're in conflict with somebody, basically you're a partner, whether you plan it or not, you're a partner. But conflict, you can go down, and it's a journey to be in conflict with somebody. But you can be in conflict with somebody forever if there's no violence in it. You don't necessarily have to resolve it, and some of them you can't resolve. But the issue is trying to keep the violence out of the conflict. And the way we believe is that, and we have certainly, there's a lot of evidence of it, is that we can help to reduce, uninvolved people can help reduce the violence in other people's conflicts. And that's the work we do, whether we do it in the U.S. at demonstrations or conflict situations, or whether we do it in the streets of the cities where there is violence in the streets of the cities, or whether we do it in other countries, is that process of trying to help reduce the violence of other conflicts. Now, one of the fun things about this, or intriguing things about this, is that we all know that if you increase the violence in a conflict, that it is likely to further increase. But the fun part is that if you can decrease the violence in the conflict, it makes room to further decrease. And we believe that if, you know, hundreds or thousands of people across the country would just get trained to do this kind of work, it could radically reduce the amount of violence in the nation. And indeed, a lot of our work can keep the police from getting involved. And I'm sorry if this offends people, but in general, when the police get involved, things get violent, people get hurt, and it's not a healthy situation. And we would be much better if we can empower communities to reduce that violence in their own community. We try to train people in their community so that they can work on that, and it's a much safer, much healthier, much stronger thing when people take that responsibility for their own community rather than calling in some kind of authority they're likely to cause further problems.
Now, since Trump came into power, have you gotten, and the Meta Peace Team gotten more popular?
Yes, there's been a shift. So what we're doing is we're getting a lot more calls for what we call bystander intervention. So instead of the regular peace team work, which is more established, in more established situations, we get a lot of bystander intervention calls for that kind of training. So the difference would be that in regular peace teamwork, frequently, so let's just say we're going to have a demonstration and there's going to be people who are going to come who are likely to cause violence. So there was recently a demonstration, a anti-immigrant demonstration, and the organizers put out a call to militia types, asking them to come armed to protect the anti-immigrant people. So this sounds like a potentially a very violent situation. But in a case like that, when somebody comes as a counter-demonstrator, they came with the intention of demonstrating. So they have they're so psychologically engaged. They want to stay there. And let me quickly step over to what I would call bystander intervention. And this is a case where somebody at the coffee shop is attacking verbally or physically, verbally, for example, a woman on a sexist line, or a Muslim on
business can be done from anywhere, in the palm of your hand,
at the source. The aggressor is sort of opportunistic, so you can use different techniques. So in the case of a bystander, most of the work we do is to encourage people to support the target, ignore the aggressor, support the target, because the target is sort of opportunistic and is looking for attention. And if they don't get attention, they kind of drift off. Meanwhile, you're fully supporting the target. In the case, the previous piece I was talking about, where a counter demonstrator comes to a march, you can't. If you support their target, they're just going to find another one. Because they came with the intention of creating that. that disruption. So in that case, you need to address the aggressor. And largely what we do there, there's a couple of techniques, but it's a number of techniques, but a lot of that work is basically listening, talking to them and getting them to be attacking you, and to be laying that anger on you, and through active listening, through paying attention to them and nodding and smiling and acting like you're really listening to them, you can keep them talking to you. And that way it makes them so they become harmless, because you can absorb that anger. You are intentionally absorbing that anger without it going out to other members in the demonstration they're less likely in general, but one of them in particular is likely to be, really react and really be hurt by it. So those are two different techniques that we're using in different situations, and we're getting a lot more calls for the bystander intervention training. And in fact, we know the case of the two who got shot, and I feel that if they had been trained by us, they wouldn't have gotten shot, because we use different techniques than they were using when they innocently and wonderfully tried to intervene in the case of what we would call of somebody attacking somebody on racist lines.
Boy. Now, I think one time you mentioned some different techniques that people would use to really kind of help break the situation up a little bit. And I think one of them, who's the juggler?
Well, there are a number of jugglers. Yeah, Peter Doherty is one of the jugglers. And that's a great technique. It's nothing I haven't learned, or maybe I should just plain learn it. So oftentimes, particularly in either situation, and that when I'm saying either, in this case I'm talking about either bystander intervention or typical peace teamwork at a demonstration, for example, trying to just distract them. So let me step back and say, in violent situations, there are three normal responses to violence that we usually use. One is that we acquiesce to the demands of the aggressor. They demand that we do something, and we go ahead and do it. The second is that we refuse to do it and respond back to them with counterviolence. And the third is that we either pretend it didn't happen or we ignore it. So that's the one that's more confusing for people. So an illustration of ignoring it would be, you're walking down the street and you see a violence, you see somebody attacking somebody else across the street and you ignore it. You see a guy trying to shove a woman against her wishes into a car and you just ignore it. Or another one might be, usually it's a woman who comes to a meeting with a book with a black eye, and she fell and hit the doorknob, or the dog did it, or there's some kind of an argument. And both of those tend to hide what happened. Now, all three of those responses are part of what we call the violent cycle. All three of them support the violent cycle. All three of them are one of the three responses the aggressor expects to have happen, and it supports their continuing their violence. So our work is to look for what we call the fourth way, something different. And that's really the key, is that it is some way of distracting, and is something totally different. So it could be juggling. And if you can draw their attention to juggling and get them thinking about it, and maybe try to engage them in it or somehow that, some form of distraction. And it could be, one of the interesting things about it is because these distractions, part of the reason they work is because they aren't related to what's actually happening. They're just like totally like kind of like off the wall. You can actually you can develop a couple of scenarios that you plan to use, you can use it again in different places. So you might use something like look at them and see if they have anything distinctive that they might be a little bit proud of: their shoes, their water bottle, their purse, their tattoo, their belt buckle, their whatever, and say, "Oh, wow, that is so cool. My brother was looking for one exactly like that. Where did you get that from?" And engage them in a big discussion about that. Or it might be something like, "Oh, my God, I'm late. I'm lost. How do I get to Times Square? Oh my God! I got my son's there. My wife showed up with her. You know, she's not responsible. She can just leave him there. How do I get in some kind of a busy engagement so that you can draw their attention and get them off of we call it distract, redirect, and reinforce. So you try to distract them from the conflict, and then you try to sort of redirect them to something else, and then you stay with that for a while until they can kind of lose their energy.
Can you share that nun story? Would that apply right now?
Which nun story was that?
Oh my goodness! I think she walked out, and there was a group of guys there. And
there's a number of stories. So there have been situations where, and I can think of actually a couple, where elderly women have walked out, and there have been some young troublemakers there who, look, she was concerned that she was carrying groceries, and she was concerned that she was going to get attacked. And she walks out and walks directly to them and says, "Oh my God, I am so glad you were here. I was really worried, and I got to get these groceries to my car. Will you help me? Will you help me carry these to the car?" And you guys do it. there's also story, little individual situations like people who have been in grocery stores and seen somebody who was, like maybe a guy who had a screaming baby, and you know how irritating a screaming baby can be, and if they're not on it, and was getting really, really angry and was like undoing the belt buckle and saying, "I'm going to give you something. You want to cry? I'll give you something to cry." And there's two different techniques I've heard people use successfully in this situation. One is to walk up to them and say, "Oh, your baby is so beautiful. It's too bad they're crying, but they are so beautiful. May I hold your baby for you?" And just disarm the situation. Another technique has been to, please don't hurt the baby now. Don't hurt the baby. To redirect it, and even to help him get through the situation, because in that case, his anger is based, it's legitimate. It isn't legitimate to push it on the children. And there's a million examples of successful work, individuals doing it by themselves or groups doing it. And groups doing it together.
Because of lack of time, I wanted to jump to Palestine and how you apply some of these techniques there and why.
Okay, so Palestine is a complicated area because we have lots of things going on. So there are areas where, for example, when they put the famous apartheid wall, the wall which is which the World Court has said is illegal and unjust because it doesn't follow the boundary, it steals land. And so part of what it did was it would cut off big chunks of farmers' land. So now they live on one side of the wall and the farmers on the other side of the wall. And in order to do their farming, they have to go through a agricultural gate. And because of the imbalance of power, you have these lowly soldiers who open and close the gate and maintain the gate, and you have the Palestinians on the other side, but there's no normal connection because they don't, because there isn't any connection up through the Palestinians down through the Israelis. So the gates are supposed to be open at 7 o'clock, and but you know the soldiers might show up at 9 o'clock because there's no effort, there's nothing to really push them to be there at 7 o'clock, but they also might show up at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. So they show up, let's just say they show up at 6 o'clock, you know, they get going a little early, they didn't mean to, but they get going a little bit early. They let all the Palestinians that are there through and don't bother to think that, you know, it's supposed to be open till 7, so therefore a farmer might show up at 7. So the result is that all the farmers have to show up at like 5 o'clock in the morning and sit there for hours waiting for the soldiers to open it. So one of the things we do is go to those gates and time when they're open and time when they're closed so that we can report to the UN so that the Israeli hierarchy begins to see that this is not okay and begin to develop some pressure on it. Other situations we've done, which were, again, with the agricultural gates, is Israelis were planning to close a gate because it was they decided it took them too much manpower. Now, they put the wall in there, and they chose to put the wall, they chose to put the gate in it, but they decided that it's too much manpower, so they started to close the gate. And by bringing a lot of international attention, we were able to keep the gate open. Now, would it last open forever? I don't know, but we certainly extended the period of time that gate continued to be used, and if that gate was closed, when you looked at the map, you realized that, oh, the gate they wanted to go through wasn't all that far away, but there was no way to get from one gate to the other gate on the other side of the wall, so that they couldn't maintain they wouldn't have been able to maintain their farms. And if they don't maintain their farms, then the Israelis take them. There's other things we've done too, which is to in areas where in some of the areas, the Israeli soldiers will just barge into a house, go up on the roof, and take charge of and occupy the roof so they can look over the area. And usually they do it at night. And just sit up there and watch everybody. And we've gotten calls that the homeowners were terrified and didn't want them there. And we found that if we just go and sit by the gate, by the door, actually we've even not even going into the house. Usually we go into the house upstairs by the gate to the roof, but. Let's look. We just sat down outside, make our presence known, and pretty soon the soldiers just leave. I don't know why they just leave. It's hard for us in the security of this country to realize the trauma. Because when they have the Israeli soldiers, when the Palestinians have the Israeli soldiers in the house, the Palestinians know they can very easily get shot just because. And that would happen without any punishment happening to the Israeli soldiers. They would come up and say, oh, well, he was threatening me or whatever. And that could happen. It's also a very real possibility that for some reason or other, one of the household members will get arrested. So having those soldiers there is very dangerous for them. And it's just amazing how thankful they are when they finally leave. And that's another piece of the work we've often done.
Well, what about the children?
The children. In fact, one of the houses where we did that in, they had gone through what was obviously the bedroom of a retarded girl. It's appalling what happens to the children, trying to live in a world where everybody's living in terror. Everybody is you know, it's very powerful when people see their parents just totally disrespected. That's very, very, very traumatizing for children, especially when it happens on an ongoing basis. And that's part of what happens there. So our efforts there, there's lots of other things. There was a university, Kuduri University, where the Israeli soldiers were just attacking the university. That would happen six out of seven days of the week. They would come on to the campus. And when they came on to the campus, so for example, I was in the cafeteria one time and I had to leave because of the tear gas. I was in an art show one time and I had to leave because of the tear gas. And as the president of the university is saying, you know, we're trying to create an environment where students can learn, where they can study, take their tests, and learn. And here we have this tear gas and people getting shot. So on a typical time that they would come on base, there would be like six students shot. Now, that would not be, that would usually be a leg wound. They would shoot them in the legs rather than shoot them in the chest. So they wouldn't be killed, but they would be maimed. And that would, usually it would be a permanent injury. And probably 20 students would be treated for gas inhalation. So it was an appalling situation. And we wound up, just trying to make a longer story short, we wound up getting permission to be up on top of the library, which was sort of the center of all of what happened. And it worked very well for us because we could go in there and do our report writing and our work using their Wi-Fi and their desks. So we could sit and wait until the Israeli soldiers showed up, and then we would go up on the roof and wear high visibility hats and vests because the university was very afraid that we would get shot by the soldiers. So what we did is we hung signs off the edge of the library when we went up there that said international observers, which of course had a couple of impacts. One is presumably it protected us, and secondly, it kind of put everybody on notice. And who knows what impact that had, but shortly after we started doing that, those attacks on the university just stopped. And that felt like we had made a difference for somebody, you know, changed the situation a little bit. So there's a lot of that work that we do in the West Bank. There's a lot of that work we can do here in the U.S. There's a lot of that work we could do. You know, can I jump to another topic?
Yes.
Which is North Korea. And again, I think that we need to look at solutions other than armed resistance. And if you look at North Korea, and you think of Kim Jong-un, the president, prime minister, I don't remember what his title is, but look at how he sees the situation. He sees a situation that Korea declared their independence at the end of World War II. The U.S. invaded, occupied Korea for a while, and there was a barrier for a while, and then we installed Lee in South Korea, and Lee kept making incursions into North Korea and threatening to attack North Korea. And then eventually North Korea came down and pushed us off into the continent. And then we moved back, peninsula, and then we moved back onto the peninsula and pushed all the way to the top, tried to completely occupy all of Korea. And then we wound up, so we're the invaders here. You got to understand, they declared their independence and they're the residents and we invaded. And then after the armistice, every single year, we have practiced the invasion of North Korea with the South Koreans. Every year we have these war games, we practice it. So you look at Kim Jong-un, he's saying, You guys want me to? What makes you think I trust you people? Why would I trust you? What are you doing? And we keep saying, well, well, we're going to, you know, so we keep threatening them with military maneuvers and with military threat. And, of course, he's been living in that all his life. There's nothing, he's not going to give in to that. That just feeds into his fear and his understanding. And he has said for himself, he has said, no nuclear nation has been invaded. And he looks at nations where we have stopped the nuclear development and then invaded. And if you look at the nations, we've invaded everybody. Libya and Syria, and we're now in Syria and Iraq, etc. If Iraq had developed a nuclear weapons, we wouldn't have invaded. So he is not going to get rid of his nuclear weapons. On the other hand, I believe that it would be fairly straightforward to work with him. Which would be to, oh yes, people say, well, China will take care of it. Well, first of all, China, the one thing China does not want is a destabilized Korea. They also don't want the U.S. too close to their border either, so that North Korea forms a boundary. But what they really don't want is the government to fall there and it go into chaos. That would be a disaster for them. So they're not capable of, I don't know what our government seems to think they're going to do, but there's a limit to what they can do. And I'm going to offer a solution I think would be very effective, which is, first of all, we're going to open up negotiations because we know that Kim Jong-un is fascinated by basketball, and start using basketball delegations. Maybe we have to say, oh, no, it's illegal, you can't do that, and have them slip up quietly or whatever we have to do to begin.
Oh, my God, they did that with baseball all over the world.
Yeah, that's right. And so open up the thing. And then what I would suggest we do, they have basically a starving nation, and we start shipping food. It's easy for us to do. We have excess food. It would be wildly cheaper than the military maneuvers we're doing. And if we were to ship so much food that we could raise the standard of living in North Korea, which we could do, if we ship so much food that we raise the standard of living, then we would have suddenly developed a control over what Kim Jong-un was doing, and we could then negotiate with him. Because we would have a little, if we had put in enough food to raise the standard of living, then it would be very hard for him to lower it again.
That would just make so much sense. And I have to put in here, guys, we are now on iHeartRadio. I did get the plug in. Uh-huh. Okay. We've got like 2 minutes left. This hour has just flown by.
Well, I think that we have to understand that military solutions rarely work. They just don't work. I was Standing Rock, and to watch what we did, what we have done, and are doing in Standing Rock, or down at Black Mesa in Arizona, to watch the way it's a standard process. It's exactly the same thing which happened in eastern United States and during the colonial days and all the way across the continent, where some business interests saw a profit in taking advantage of the Native Americans. They did some kind of a legal negotiation maneuver or trick, and then the U.S. government comes in and reinforces it with the courts or with the soldiers. That's how we took the Black Hills in South Dakota. We've done it again and again and again. I think it's really important to understand it has not stopped. What is happening in the lake there, I'm missing the name of it, which the pipeline, the DAPL pipeline, is going underneath. That was a stealing of land also. We decided to build a lake, and I've met people whose houses were flooded. Our engineer just told them, move out. It's no longer your house. It's going underwater. So that's important. I think it's really important for us as citizens understand this process is no different than it was in colonial days, and the stealing of land and the crushing of people and the depriving them of their rights. And you know, it's comfort for me to sort of feel like, oh, well, we did a terrible thing in the old days, but we don't do that anymore. It isn't true. We're still doing it to the Native Americans right now.
Elliot,
right in this country.
We've got probably 45 seconds. You know, I hate to interrupt you. I really do. You were so incredible. But if somebody wanted to get a hold of you to join the MetaPeace team and learn from you, how did they do it?
So we have a website. Thank you, Kathy, for focusing me again. We have a website, which is MetaPeace Team, M-E-T-A, MetaPeaceTeam.org. Contact us through that. Contact me through that. You can contact me directly. I'll give you my email address. It's Elliot Adams, ELLIOTTADAMS at Juno, JUNO.com. And we can work together. We can work together to make this a better world, a more just world, a more profitable world for all of us, and a safer world for all of us. And I think that there's a lot of myths, and once you get around the myths, and Lord knows I've worked hard enough to get around them, that I think we see real possibilities for creating a better world for all of us, and not, yeah.
Wow. Will you promise to come back after you come back from Palestine and talk about your trip?
I would love to, Kathy, and I appreciate all the work you do trying to get rid of those myths I was talking about, trying to help people see the truth and the love and move in a better direction.
No, we do the same thing, just with different methods.
That's right. That's right. It's all, we all work together.
Well,
and
on that,
everybody who's listening can help us. They can join us in doing this important work.
Absolutely. The more, the merrier. And on that note, we got to say aloha, everybody, and have a great week, and we'll catch you next week. Aloha.
Thank you.